Welcome to Baggage. I'm one of the hosts, Ryan Frank, along with Ryan Connor and Adrian Bonneberger. How are you guys doing?
Doing well.
Great.
And let me also apologize. I'm just getting over a cold. So if I sound a little off, it is, trust me, it's still me. And of course, this episode, we have one of our hosts who is also a guest, Eric Shaw. I'll turn it over to you.
So after medical school is residency, and this is where doctors go and train for their subspecialty. And then whether that's surgery or internal medicine, or for me, it was pediatrics. It's anywhere from 3 to 5 years of basic training. It can be more if you do a further subspecialty, say like neurology or cardiology or something like that. But I did, you know, it's basic pediatrics, and that was a 3-year residency. A lot of people complain about residency as just being, you know, really, really hard and really, really like they work you. And it's true. They made a law that you could only work 80 hours a week, and they've switched that around a little bit. And I think at the time they paid us around $40,000 a year to work 80 hours a week. So it was effectively 2 less than minimum wage jobs that you had to work all the time. But I absolutely loved it. And I did residency at the Children's Hospital of the King's Daughters in Norfolk, Virginia. It's one of the few freestanding children's hospitals in Virginia. And I had an absolutely wonderful experience. It was, the hospital was completely dedicated to the residency program. We were kind of a pillar of the community. Everybody loved us. And we had tons and tons of resources. We learned so, so much, but like we were there all the time, just work, 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 work. But it was probably one of the most satisfying and challenging times of my life, where I was finally getting to do what I wanted to do and learning all about it. And like in medical school, we talk about drinking from the fire hose, where you're just being inundated with information, where this was similar, but you were actually putting it to work as you did it. And so it was a very different experience there. I loved every minute of it. We had a great class. We all got along. I'd say I don't really have a lot of stories coming out of residency. I think the thing that started to hit me with in residency was some of the scenarios where it was death and dying, but with children. And that was a very different animal from what I'd experienced before. And for the most part, it wasn't like the trauma stuff I'd seen before. It wasn't like the paramedic stuff where it was brutal and it was fast and it was bloody. This was usually slower and more nuanced, and everybody saw it coming, but it didn't make it any easier to be in the room with having to tell parents that their child was dying and having to sit there and watch them hold their child as the child died. And there was many experiences like that in residency, particularly in the NICU and subsequently in the PICU. We had one terrible week in the PICU where we lost like 5 or 6 kids in 1 week. And normally, you know, a good week is none or one at the most. So to lose 5 in 1 week kind of tore up the whole team. But all in all, it was a very, very different experience. I walked away from residency with nothing but positive thoughts. And I came out into as I finished, completely ready to go as far as like competency and capability. And from there, I moved out to Colorado. My wife is from Richmond, Virginia. I'd, you know, done med school there, and we weren't super keen on Norfolk, although we did like the residency program. And we decided that we wanted to move where we'd been vacationing, which was Colorado. And I had some friends out here. We had some family out here. And so we just kind of pulled the trigger and moved. When I first moved out here, I got a job with a emergency room company. I'm not going to name names here, but it was not ideal. It was a good position to kind of get my foot in the door and kind of get the lay of the land of Colorado. But that was just not perfect. And ultimately, it wasn't so much the cases or the patients that I didn't like. It was the hours. I am a 9-to-5 human being. I learned that about myself, like trying to do night shifts to day shifts to then the worst was the evening shifts, where it was like working from 2 in the afternoon until midnight. And my wife and I would sleep in the same bed and for days or weeks and not talk to each other, where, you know, she was asleep when I got home and I was asleep when she woke up. And that was kind of our new pattern.
Can I ask you a question about that then?
Sure.
Since you say you feel like a 9-to-5 person. So residency, you say there's a cap at 80 hours. I remember at the time you telling me that, and I can't remember how many hours were people were doing over 100 before this sometimes, correct? And then Sort of a three-part question here. Also, once they cut to 80 hours, is that in 5 days? Is that over 7 days? Are you guaranteed one day off or anything like that? Also, in these shifts, say if you're doing a 16-hour shift, do you have like a couple one-hour breaks where you can go in a room and lay down just to get off your feet or something, or to reset your brain because you just saw something absolutely awful? How do you cope with all this?
Yes, no, and maybe. Things have kind of changed. I can explain to you like how it was when I was there, but things even changed during the time period that I was there. So the rules that were in place for me were different for what was the interns as I wrapped up. So for me, it was you could only work an average of 80 hours per week in a month. So there were some weeks it was more and there were some weeks it was less. I've heard many surgical programs have largely ignored that, and they work 100 to 120 hours a week. We didn't, but it was generally 80 plus hours a week. When you were on the floor teams, you would take call. And what that meant was you'd come in at 6 o'clock on your primary morning. You'd stay overnight. You'd round the next morning with a team, and you'd leave roughly around noon the next day. So you were at the hospital for 36 plus hours. Sleeping was optimistic. Sometimes you did, sometimes you didn't. It just depended on kind of like how busy things were. So like when swine flu, I know this seems like so long ago, when that first swine flu outbreak came through, like we were super busy and like everybody was on call kind of all the time. And you didn't sleep and you were just going on caffeine. And I'll kind of follow up on that because there's some neat studies out there as far as like what is the safest practice. And there's not a perfect answer on this one. But there were times I'd be so tired. I actually did fall asleep on my feet. I didn't know that that was possible, but that actually is possible. I was standing at a nurse station, and I kind of leaned over like this and put my head down and started to slide and fall over, and one of the nurses grabbed me and sat me down in a chair. I was doing lines in the NICU, and we do umbilical lines on these babies where you actually put like a little catheter through their umbilical vein into them that way, because it's much easier and it's a much larger tube that you can put things like, you know, food basically through TPN. It's a sterile procedure, and so you're not supposed to touch anything, and I'm in like this gown, I've got these gloves, but you have to get x-rays to confirm it. And I sat down in the chair and I couldn't put my arms up and lean back, and I just fell asleep sitting upright in the chair until they got the x-ray back. So like you'd be exhausted sometimes. As far as like the safety stuff,
That's some pretty important, like fine motor skill type of skills you need to have. And if you were a trucker, they would make you pull over hours
probably.
You know, that's or crazy because they have like federal pilot and stuff. But it's like, why?
There's a couple. Ways to look at it.
Why is that?
Part of it is the going back to the break you down to build you back up. If you can do it under those circumstances, it's second nature. Like you're not even thinking about it anymore. It's almost just like fall back on your training. You know what to do. These things are instinctual.
Brian and Adrian, does that resonate with you guys with military training too? Sort of just doing the impossible so that later on nothing is impossible. Is it that kind of same sort of training principle?
I would also add that when we're talking about medical residency, you have to consider the man who was responsible for creating the modern template for residency, a guy named William Halsted. And if you want a wild Wikipedia read, you can look him up. He's still sort of, his methods are still sort of at the heart of residencies in general, but very much so with surgery. He was a surgeon at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, went from Yale to Johns Hopkins, started Johns Hopkins Medical School, and really sincerely viewed the vocation of medicine as like something akin to a religious order, like monks. He was modeling it on a monastic order.
They call it residency for a reason. You lived at the hospital. It was your residence.
And in fact, it's still called, I edited a medical journal briefly for about 5 years, and it's still called house staff. It's not actually, they're not like, if you look at, or at least that's how it was at Yale, they're not called residents at Yale. They're called house staff So when I first got there, I'm looking, you know, through the Yale Medical Journal. I'm like, where is residency? Why is nobody listing where their residency is? And it's like, no, house staff. It's where they did. But to answer, you know, yeah, you know, absolutely, the military views training that way. And I think probably, you know, the religious orders, my guess is all of those things that consider the forging of an identity as part of the training, medicine, law to a certain extent, religious orders probably go back to military orders. I think even before you had religious orders, you had military orders. There were always people, you know, chimpanzees can use tools to bash each other over the head. You know, a dolphin hunt in pods. But they don't, as far as I know, have religion. So if you're a Darwinist, then you believe that these things actually developed out of some sort of, you know, hazing set of rituals in the military.
Sounds a lot like when I work at Boston Market too, but.
Yeah, I was going to say. I understand. Actually, that reasoning makes sense. Like, kind of like break you down. Like, if you can get through this crucible of residency, then we're going to let you in our order. I understand that philosophy of it, but it doesn't really compare to the military in the sense of it was a lot of muscle memory. Like, you just will know this inherently and you can react. But
no, it was the same. It was the same for us of like, you recognize the scenario as, you know, this kid's in respiratory distress, or this kid has a surgical abdomen, or this kid has meningitis. Like, you, one of the biggest things that they push into us. And I had the advantage of, I had a lot of experience with this already before medical school, is like being able to eyeball a patient and tell if sick versus not sick within 10 seconds or less. You just look at them, you're like, that is a problem. We need to fix that right now. And so particularly in the ER setting or even on the floor, like just be able to identify that was a very, very important skill. But to expand on the concept of like safety and safety nets in the hospital, as a resident, you had a lot of safety nets. It was really hard to screw something up as the resident. First and foremost, you were really just kind of the, again, comparing to the military stuff, you as an intern, you were a second lieutenant. You were less than nothing. Like, the nurses had no respect for you. You were a rubber stamp just there, kind of like doing scut work, doing busy work, but like, you had no real power. Like, you couldn't do anything. As a senior, second year, and then subsequently a third year resident, senior resident, you're more of like a captain or a major, where you were now had like other interns underneath you that you were making sure that they did all their stuff and that you were more overseeing their work. And then the attending, you know, the actual like boss, if you will, was the kind of the colonel that was, you know, overseeing the whole thing. So he actually, whoever the colonel was, whoever the attending was, had the ultimate responsibility of what was going on. But in a teaching hospital, you also have usually a rock solid nursing staff. And then you also have like the pharmacy backing things up. So you have multiple checks and balances. You know, your order may go on the paper, but it came down from the attending and the nurse is going to check it. And the nurse is going to check with their charge nurse. And then that's going to go through the pharmacy and they're going to check it too. So it's pretty hard to make a mistake where anybody could conceivably get hurt. As far as the hours go, that changed. And I can't say for the good or for bad, as I wrapped up, it moved into a 16-hour shift model. The problem with that was the residents never got time off. They could only be at the hospital for 16 hours total and then had to go home. But because of that, the way it stacked up, we got like a golden weekend where we got like a day off over the weekend. It was only like one or two days out of the month. But with the 16-hour schedule, they just never got time off. They were constantly there. And the other part of that too is in medical care, there always has to be handoffs at some point. You got to pass your patient list on to the next person coming on, the next team member, or the night resident or whoever it is. And that's dangerous too. And they've actually done studies on this. Think of it as like a game of telephone. There's always miscommunication with this. And computer stuff has made it better. But at the end of the day, it is still one human passing off a list of, say, anywhere from a dozen to 30 patients. And of like, this needs to be done, this needs to be done, follow up on this note, follow up on this procedure. And things get missed. And so being there and being tired, there's a degree of continuity. Yes, you're tired, but like, it was you that were doing it all and you kind of knew what was going on. With the more handoffs you add in there, the higher the risk of danger goes. So again, neither model is perfect. And I don't think any system or any residency program has dialed in like what is the best way to do it. Okay, so moving on to being in Colorado and working for the ER group. I worked for three different hospitals in the Denver area. And for the most part, I really liked most of the staff that I worked with. I liked most of the patient populations I was working with. It was really interesting. A lot of diversity, particularly at the hospital I worked at in Aurora. Like the amount of diversity I saw out there was amazing. We had a translator phone. We called it like it was a blue phone. So we called it the blue phone. And there were some times where people would come in with some of these like Southeastern Asian languages that even the translator was like, I don't know what this is. This is kind of close to Bangladeshi, but like, I can't really understand them. And so we just had to work through some of the stuff. So it was really neat to work in that environment. I have two, if not three stories that kind of were big and also kind of tied together why I didn't want to do ER anymore. My first one was my first night at a new hospital, and this was at North Suburban up in Thornton, Colorado. And I didn't know the hospital at all. I didn't know the logistics of how things worked. And again, it was my first night there, and the ER or the paramedic group shows up with a kid that I can see just on the stretcher has a surgical abdomen. And we didn't have ped surgery at this hospital. And I was like, you can't stop here. Like you can't be here. That kid's going to die. And we don't have the means to fix him. And he's like, too late. We're here. He's yours. And the story was, he had had something called a Nissen fundoplication where he had such bad reflux that they literally tied the top of his stomach together so that food could go down, but nothing else could come up. And people will talk about that. You can't vomit with a Nissen. Well, that's kind of true. But you can retch really hard against it. And this kid was not supposed to be eating anything solid for several weeks or days after a surgery. And he was autistic and he'd snuck into the cabinet and ate a shit ton of cookies and peanut butter and then began to retch against his Nissen, which then ripped. And so he basically had a hole in his esophagus or his stomach that was now filling his entire abdominal cavity with air, peanut butter, and cookie bits. And thankfully, I had the head of the respiratory team interviewing a potential RT in the ER department come and help me. And we intubated this kid. We got the lines in. I called Life Flight and they were like, we don't normally fly someone from there. We'll just take the ambulance. I was like, this kid's not going to survive. Like, he needs to go. Like, he needs to be in the OR 10 minutes ago. And we decompressed his stomach. We did everything we could. And that kid left the hospital modestly stable. And I was pretty sure that he was not going to make it. And when I ultimately followed up in the next couple of days with the PICU doctors, like he did fine. They took him to surgery. They washed out all the peanut butter and cookie bits. And I don't know if he did fine, but he did survive that. And that was a big one. That was like, I'm particular for being on my first day there. That was kind of harkening back to like my paramedic days where I was like, I did something really good. Like I actually saved that kid. So that was nice, but it was still just one where I was like, holy crap, what have I gotten into? Where as a paramedic, it was all protocol driven and I was kind of all falling back on that. Whereas this was like, I have to make all these decisions. And kind of like we talked about with the residency, like now I'm the colonel, I'm the one that's delegating everything. So it's just a lot more responsibility on my plate.
Do you think without that paramedic experience, you would have had the confidence to do it that way, to make those decisions?
Hard to say. Residency is so powerful. And you learn so much in residency that I would say any residency worth its salt is going to put out a attending that should be able to handle just about any situation. I mean, so there are like, you know, personal aspects of it that may play a role. And I think that my paramedic stuff definitely gave me the ability to make snap judgments like that more comfortably than I think most people. So I think it was beneficial in that sense. As time progressed, the whole work life balance thing of the ER started to suck. And I got extremely lucky. My current position as a partner with Pediatrics West, I got by pure luck. And thanks to another pediatrician named Jim Campbell, who lives in my neighborhood. Shout out to you, Jim. This is, I still owe you. I've offered many times to take him out to dinner and he always says it was no big deal. But I would not have this job if it weren't for Jim. I was outside doing some lawn work and he rode by on his bike and he's like, hey, I heard there's another pediatrician in the neighborhood. I just want to say hi. And I'm like, hi, how you doing? Nice to meet you. And he's like, you wouldn't have to be looking for a new job, would you? And I'm like, well, I'm not looking for a job. What are we talking about? And I interviewed with Pediatrics West and got the position. And it's been almost 12 years and it's been fantastic. Like this, if you'd asked me 12 years ago, like, what do you want to do? Where do you want to be? It's doing exactly what I'm doing, which is outpatient, you know, pediatrics. But I kept on with the ER group for a little bit, more so for financial reasons and just to kind of wind things up with them. And on my last day there, I got such a kick in the teeth kind of scenario that just reinforced everything I'd been thinking, that like, I didn't like ER medicine. I didn't like sick patients. I didn't want to deal with trauma and blood and drama overall. And it was a 2-year-old that came in cardiac arrest. The paramedics were working him actively. And when we got him, he was still in PEA or pulseless electrical activity, which means his heart was still trying from an electrical standpoint, but not really responding well. And with these scenarios, particularly in the paramedic world, they tell you to work these kids hard because a kid is not dead until they are like cold and dead. Everyone tries to get them back as hard as they can. And so we took over and worked this kid very, very hard. We intubated him. We got a central line in him. We started to do all the meds. We were doing the whole protocol there. And as we're doing this, the person who I thought was his mother was sitting kind of in the corner looking, you know, obviously very upset about this and just trying to take it in. As we order the blood work on him, one thing that we assess is called a blood gas, and it can tell you how acidotic somebody is. And the longer you have not been breathing or adequately moving blood around, the higher the acid levels of your blood get. Cause you're basically, it's a very inefficient way to run a human body, and the cells start to build up acid as a side effect to it. And when we got his back, it was astronomically high. And it told me that he had been mostly dead or dead longer than we anticipated. And at that point, I told everyone that we need to stop and this was not, you know, going to be successful. And so we stopped and we called it. And I talked to the mom, and it turns out that was his foster mother. And the story that she gave was that he had been in the process of getting worked up for seizures. She'd put him down for a nap, and when she came in, he was unresponsive. So most likely he'd had a big seizure while he was napping, and that's what did this. So I explained to her, you know, that we did everything we could, and that was it. About an hour later, maybe half an hour later, his biological mother came in, and I had to have the same conversation with her. And about an hour or two after that, the biological father came in, and I had to have the same conversation with him. And to do that 3 times in a row in one day was just enough where I just, again, it wasn't like before where it was so jarring, like the surgical stuff, but it was just something where I felt so sure of my, where I was heading and what I was getting away from, where I was like, I can't do this again. I am not made for this. This is just not something I can do and look at myself in the mirror every day and be happy. Like, it's just too caustic to my soul and my well-being. So at that point in my life, after walking out of that ER, and I looked back kind of collectively at all the things that I'd seen and done, I recognized that I had been present for the death of at least probably 40, if not more, people. And for at least somewhere between 10 to a dozen of those had actually watched the lights go out at that last moment. And that is something that I collectively have just felt was very damaging to my well-being. It's one thing to be able to you know, compartmentalize death or think about a, you know, a relative or someone that's died, but to be that close to it that many times begins to kind of take something out of you, and particularly the ones where it was that immediate and you could see them transition, was something that I will always carry with me, and I have not found a good solution to working around yet. But it helped me to move into my new job to realize that I was putting that behind me. It is something that I feel has had more long-term repercussions. I don't think it's good for anybody to be that close to death that many times. But it has just further reinforced my choices and my decisions to move into outpatient pediatrics and to take a life that is, or choose a lifestyle that's less stressful and further removed from death and closer to new life and something that's more fun and genuinely more satisfying to me and not dealing with the stresses of that over and over and over again.
Okay. So Eric, everything is so intense. Is there anything that's like light and funny, like that you would work in an ER and you would come home and be like, ah, the funniest thing happened? Is it ever anything like that? Or is it just always just insanely intense?
No, it's not always insanely intense. There is some funny stuff. It's sometimes macabre humor or something that's just like funny because it's so odd. I think one of the more interesting and slightly comical ones that I saw was that I got to help participate in a exorcism. This was at the ER in Aurora. And as I mentioned before, with Aurora, it's extremely diverse. That's where like the majority of the minority populations in the Denver area lives in Aurora. A lot of like Southeast Asian families, like Bangladeshis, mm-hmm. Burmese and around that area, but also a lot of Central Americans, a lot of South Americans. And I believe this family was from Guatemala or somewhere there in Central America. And the girl came in basically talking in tongues. And from a medical standpoint, we look at this and call this a conversion reaction. This is where someone has suffered some sort of stressful event and they just kind of go on overload and they'll do very, very odd things like, you know, with kids, they'll just kind of like lose it and they'll have meltdowns and they're crying hysterically and mm-hmm. they'll have all sorts of issues along those lines. But what's neat is there is a kind of crossroads of mental health, culture, and sometimes a degree of religiosity, depending on their background, that can start to play into things. So good examples of the mental health stuff is a lot of these ideas of what you should do when you're having a psychotic break or what some of the paranoid delusions are very culturally driven. So back in the 60s, when Sputnik went up, you heard about people wearing like tinfoil hats on their head mm-hmm. because they were worried they were trying to block the radio signals there. The kids with significant depression and anxiety that will do cutting as a form of coping mechanism, that really didn't start until the late 90s in that movie Girl Interrupted.
That started it?
It didn't start it, but it took it to a level that it had never existed before.
It really popped
it wasn't
it.
It wasn't like a social norm. Not that it really is now, but that like brought it to everybody's acknowledgement. And after that, like everybody who was depressed would like cut themselves.
Can you tell me what the... Sorry to get away from this exorcism thing, the cutting thing, though. I'm just curious. Why do people do that? I've only heard things that sound like cliches.
It's absolutely fascinating why they do it. And it's not, it's somehow not as bad as you think it is, but it's also somehow more morbidly worse when you think about it. So they don't want to hurt themselves. When people have very, very significant depression, they'll develop something called anhedonia, which is the inability to make themselves happy. And it's as that spirals further down, you develop a sense of numbness where you're definitely not happy. But you're so numb, you're not even like registering that you're unhappy. Mm-hmm. And people are so desperate for any type of feeling. And whether it's good, bad, whatever, they'll take what they can get. And so the cutting produces two things. You get a physical feeling with it, but you also get an endorphin release with it and kind of,
right.
Excitement's not the right way of putting it, but a kind of jolt or something to just say like, I'm still alive.
Right.
And so people will do it is this like extreme unhealthy coping mechanism. Mm-hmm. So these people are generally not suicidal. Right. They may be that in addition to it. But that the cutting portion of it is not a sign of suicidal ideation. So okay. Again, it is somehow not as bad, but also just disturbingly worse when you think about it at the root level of it, of like how bad it's gotten that they feel that that is.
So hold on, what happened with this exorcism?
Okay, so the girl came in, she's talking in tongues, she's doing like the decerebrate rigidity, kind of like up, you know, grabbing at the air. And you know, I'm like, you need some antipsychotics. So we get her kind of set up with a line and I give her some Haldol, and I'm not even sure what else I did at that point. But things that are going to kind of settle her down and kind of slow things down. But she still was like really good there for a while. And the family comes in and they're like, we would like our priest to come in and perform an exorcism. And I'm like, man, I got all night. I'd love to watch this. Like, it's not going to change my care plan at all. Let's do this. This was, I didn't record it. I thought that would be distasteful. So the priest came in and it was just like what you see in the movies. It was, he had holy water and he was making the signs of the cross, and the family was standing around, holding hands. And despite the large amount of Haldol that I'd given her, she was growling and, kind of arching her back. And yeah, it lasted maybe about like 10, 15 minutes, and she started kind of to settle down into it.
Can I ask you a question? This might be insensitive, but if you were to walk out of the room, just because, I mean, you're a doctor, but you're also a person. If you walk out and someone says, what's going on in there? Do you say the medical, would you use the medical terminology, or would your first thing be like, she's fucking crazy?
well, that's not a nice. I've gotten in trouble calling people crazy when I used to teach at Red Rocks. Uh-huh. The students there apparently got very upset with me for using the term crazy. So they always make the analogy mental health stuff. Everything runs very strongly in families. Mm-hmm. And my joke was always, it's not even a joke, but it is, crazy finds crazy and crazy makes more crazy. Mm-hmm. Because people who have mental health issues will tolerate people with other mental health issues. Mm-hmm. Whereas like the average person who dates someone with bipolar will be very put off by most of their behaviors. Whereas someone who already has like depression, or their father had, you know, bipolar, will be like, I can fix this. I can deal with this. Mm-hmm. And so that just the cycle continues.
Yeah.
But I try not to use the word crazy, which we're using a lot right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, I was just wondering, because it just seems like, I mean, it's so far beyond anything I can even imagine seeing.
Yeah. But, I mean, and you know, here we are talking about crazy, and like I'm talking about my own mental health issues. So, mm-hmm. Pot kettle here.
Yeah.
Not
crazy. I'm saying like there's some crazy shit going on, is what I'm saying, just to be clear.
You got to believe in the crazy shit for that to happen. I mean,
yeah.
So I'm kind of agnostic, if we will, and so mm-hmm. for me, like it's hard to buy into the religiosity aspect of it, but I understand the purpose of it, and if it's something that, like, if that person believes thoroughly enough in it, that may be driving part of the conversion reaction that they're having. Like, mm-hmm. if they really feel that there's demons in them, that's clearly very distressing, and it's just going to up the anxiety, it's going to up this reaction that they're having. So if we can provide something outside of pharmacological means of helping them, I have no problem with it. And that's why I said this was totally fine. Like I didn't think it was going to make the scenario any worse. Mm-hmm. And so we let them do the exorcism, and between that and the Haldol, she settled down and took a nice long nap. And, by the end of my shift, she was lucid, awake, and we'd set up, outpatient mental health care for her. And it was all in all a enlightening and successful experience.
Let me guess. In the end, the glory went to God, not Haldol. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. No one jumped out a window down the stairs afterwards. There was no head spinning, no vomiting of split pea soup, but it was very successful.
Oh, my God. That is amazing. I just rewatched that movie, by the way.
Oh, that's a good one. The first one is in my top like 20 favorite movies. It's so good on every level.
Yeah. It really is. Man, well, so... are you glad you left that world and got into pediatrics?
Doing outpatient pediatrics has been absolutely wonderful. I love what I do. I've made the joke even in residency, like I don't like sick patients. Like I like well visits. I like doing community stewardship. I like doing patient advocacy. I like doing all those sort of things. And I would say in the 12 years I've been doing this, I've had maybe 3 or 4, maybe 5 patients die total out of 2,500. I don't deal with death. I don't deal with this trauma stuff. The worst stuff I deal with now is like kind of basic mental health stuff. Once in a while, some like weird, you know, disorders. But at the end of the day, like it is mostly like your baby's awesome. Everything looks great. High five. See you in a couple months. So like it is a much better place. And I have slowly but surely kind of clawed back my humanity. And I talk about this a lot with my students and many of my friends of just getting out of that world was the best thing that's ever happened to me. And I didn't know, I couldn't see like the forest for the trees of like how bad things had been until I got out of it. And so I want to read something. I want to read the definition of complex post-traumatic stress disorder. Cause that's kind of where I've landed at this point. It says, is a stress-related mental disorder generally occurring in response to complex traumas, i.e. commonly prolonged or repetitive exposures to series of traumatic events within which individuals perceive little or no chance of escape. In the ICD-11 classification, complex PTSD is a category of post-traumatic stress disorder with three additional clusters of significant symptoms. Emotional dysregulation, negative self-beliefs, i.e. feelings of shame, guilt, failure, or wrong reasons, and interpersonal difficulties. I kind of looked at like what I experienced almost being not fully the right example, but close enough of like the frog in the boiling water of like when I was in it, I didn't see it happening. And it was only when I was able to kind of step back from it that I realized like how my emotional centers kind of got short circuited. And a lot of those factors that are in that definition are things that I deal with on a general basis. I think the biggest ones for me are kind of like the emotional dysregulation, where I have, for all intents and purposes, kind of like chronic apathy. Like it's hard for me to get excited about things. I don't really get upset terribly over things, but I'm just like a constant, on a scale of 1 to 10, you know, 1 being the best day, 10 being the worst, I am a constant 5 all the time. And I mean, like, there's been big moments for me, like my kids getting this job, you know, all these successful things I can look back on and very objectively say, like, oh, these are very positive. But like in that time period, I just don't get excited about stuff. The weird feelings of like, I don't have feelings of guilt or shame, but just there are times where I'm just like so down on myself for no reason, absolutely none. And it's like, it could be a great day. And I'm just like, yep. Yeah, you're a piece of crap. There's no reason for it. And I'm just like, and objectively, the little voice in the back of my head's like, no, no, you're fine. Like, look at all these positives. And it's like, no, no, you're still a piece of crap. And it's been a long, arduous road forward from where I was to get to where I am right now and taking more responsibility about it and trying to be a better person. But I had to recognize it as a problem. And that took years. I think I always knew it was there under the surface, but it wasn't until I really had my kids that I started to look at it more of a problem. And you know,
let me ask you, Eric, real quick, because I want to make sure we're understanding the timeline. So you moved to Colorado and then you're a licensed doctor at that point, correct?
Correct.
Now, how long are you doing that before your current setup as a pediatrician?
I worked for the ER group for about a year. And then okay. I kind of transitioned into the my current job after about like, I think it was somewhere between 6 and 9 months of being out here.
And you were married by the time you went out to Colorado. No kids while you're doing the ER, correct?
Yeah.
And you had said you were just a constant 5. Like it took an awful lot for you to be way high or low or have a big reaction. Can you, looking back, can you find a time period where like, oh, I wasn't always like that? Was there a moment or a specific span of college. Time? Did it start as a paramedic?
I mean, in college, like it was wonderful. I'd always talk like if I go back to any time, it was like college. Like you're just so carefree. You have so many opportunities. Like everything is awesome. You have no real responsibilities. It was a slow burn too. Like that didn't happen overnight. I think between the stuff of the paramedic. Where again, and it was different philosophies as it evolved. As a paramedic, I was like, this is good. This is how you're supposed to be. You're supposed to be hard. You're supposed to be strong about it. I went into medical school really thinking I was going to do ER medicine because I felt that like I was drawn to that because I could do it, because I was hard enough to do it. And it wasn't until I got away from it that I was like, no, I'm not. I'm soft as baby poo. Like, I don't want to be doing this. And then it was in medical school with the trauma surgery stuff where it just kind of really broke me down of just like, this is god awful. I don't want to be seeing this anymore. And that was kind of like the 1-2 punch. That final stuff with the trauma surgery really messed me up. And so like getting out into the real world and getting out of these scenarios where I'm constantly under stress, let me finally reflect on like how pathologic that was and the kind of real world consequences that it had on my psyche.
How long do you think that process was from like, all right, you're not doing the ER anymore. You're seeing, newborn babies and everything's great. At how long are you in that world before you start looking at it and say, wow, I think that stuff really affected me.
I think I started to really notice it after my daughter was born. And some of the things as well, like, I mean, just as an aside, you guys have seen that show Dexter, where he's a serial killer. And not to say that my neighbor thought I was a serial killer, but the guy always talks about like not feeling anything, not getting any response. And my neighbor's like, dude, you're Dexter. And I'm like, if I had feelings, that would hurt. And he's like, Jesus. And he's like, I thought that was a joke. And I was like, once I had my daughter, just things started to hit a little bit differently. And when I first started as an outpatient pediatrician, part of it was getting away from the ER world. Part of it was just my mental state and like the way I was kind of conditioned to feel things, where I got like several like comments or complaints that I was just cold, that I wasn't caring. And it's not that was true. Like I had empathy, but it didn't register. It was just like blunt. And I had to get, it's taken me 12 years to get better at that. And again, this has all been like a day over day kind of clawing things back to get more in a better headspace. And there was moments too, where like just things kind of like got weird. Like I'm not an emotional person, but like, this is a really embarrassing one. When I cried like a little baby during The Good Dinosaur, like when his dad dies, like I was sitting there with my kid and that just hit me like a ton of bricks. And it was just so stupid. I'm like, why am I, and my wife looks at me, she's like, are you crying? I'm like, no, no. She's like, this is a child's movie. What's wrong with you? I mean, there's a lot of things like that where just things hit kind of weird. Or they land differently with me where it either registers as like more of a problem or I think the hardest thing for me is just like, it's not anhedonia. So if you look that up, anyone who's had depression, there's a something called anhedonia where it's the inability to make yourself happy. This is not that at all. Like I am generally a pretty happy guy. I laugh, I have fun, I can enjoy myself, but I just, again, there's this hard to pin down kind of sense of emotional dysregulation where just there's no swings. It's just a constant static. It's gotten better, but it's definitely there. Adrian, I'd like to hear from you. I know I've heard some of your interviews on like CPR or NPR talking about your kind of stress responses as you came back from war. And I just want to see if any of this, how you dealt with some of your stressors. And
yeah, everything that you've said sounds really familiar to me, especially the, being overwhelmed by melodramatic or cheap sentimentalism in films. When I was a young man watching the movies, I would watch whatever and I wouldn't, have any type of emotional response to it. But starting with my first deployment, I remember watching things and just suddenly, like the opening of the second Star Trek reboot, like where they Spock beams down into a volcano and then they rescue the alien world, just kind of because it's the right thing to do. And I found myself just like, uncontrollably weeping and attempting with, I hope, some success to conceal that from others. I don't know, how we deal with it. I think everybody deals with it differently. I think the best of us look to stories and, archetypes, like Jungian archetypes. How do you behave? And that gives you a template for what right and wrong is. So if you're a healer, then, you behave like a healer. And when you get down, you can look at that and say, well, At least I'm kind of doing things the way I'm supposed to be doing them. And education helps with that. Or your parents, you know, like I had a great dad, you know, my dad is great and I want to be like my dad. If my dad's proud of me, then I know I'll be okay. So, you know, I mean, emotions are, I don't have an MD or a PhD in psychiatry, but this is just sort of experientially going to war and seeing, not just seeing, but doing really bad things, you know, hurting people or killing people and delighting in that. That's the point of what you're doing. You're going after bad people who are doing bad things until they stop, with the hope or expectation that they stop. But on a human to human level, you end up leaving war with, you know, these sort of, you know, images of bodies that were your friends or are soldiers, but they got messed up by an IED, or worse, they're dead, or enemies, you know, that you dropped bombs on or shot or whatever. And you know, when you leave, they definitely, you know, you're carrying them with you. I think, you know, to answer your question about, you know, how do you deal with it? How do you get on with your life? For me personally, it was very much through, you know, narrative frameworks, stories, archetypes, and the knowledge that, you know, the whole time I was there, probably like you, as a doctor, you're trying to do the right thing. You're trying to do something good. I was there, you know, I was an infantry officer in Afghanistan twice. I did two combat deployments. And the reason I was in the army was to be a decent leader. I wasn't like an awesome combat, you know, leader / combat soldier by any means. I think I was on the balance. I think I was average. I think I was okay. I had really great days. And there were, you know, times that I didn't have great days. That's probably the same for everybody, just about everybody I knew in combat. You know, everything doesn't always go your way, because whoever the enemy is they're also trying to do bad stuff. But, you know, like as a doctor, you know, sometimes you get a patient that can be saved and you can work hard and work on them and get them out of the bad position they're in. Sometimes you get, you know, somebody that maybe one in a million with the best doctor on the best day, maybe they could have done something. And you got to try anyway, cause it's a person, but probably it's not going to work out okay. And then those are the, you know, yeah, I think what rescues a person long-term from, not necessarily PTSD, not necessarily having bad thoughts or you know, struggling with one's memories, but like the light at the end of the tunnel, the proverbial light at the end of the tunnel, the thing that gives you the best opportunity to move on and have a solid, well-adjusted, not antisocial, not cynical life, where you can move forward and contribute to your family and your community and still take some pride in the job you do, is understanding that what you're doing is a good thing and a right thing.
I forget the philosopher, but he talked about the hierarchy of coping mechanisms, and altruism was number one. It's the most mature coping mechanism, and followed closely by humor, which are like in healthcare, we always kind of fall back on that of like, we're doing the right things and we have a very awful macabre sense of humor and can make some really like gallows humor jokes as we go.
I can relate to that. I think everybody in like high stress jobs are like, it doesn't translate well at like dinner parties.
No. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like one of the ER jokes that's always awful is like, yeah, all bleeding stops eventually. It's like, oh, okay.
Right. You tell what that one. You got to watch it. You say it around.
Exactly. Yeah. Going back to some of the long-term kind of consequences and issues I've had. One other one that's interesting is, whereas before I used to think that I was so good at handling stress of just packing it down and not dealing with it or whatever. Now I become incredibly bad at handling stress. And I think the COVID pandemic was a perfect example where like everything just came shooting back up in a giant geyser of stress and dysfunction. And my coping mechanisms are basically to hide in my office, play video games and drink beer and basically ignore everything else. And that is my fallback. When things got bad or when I'm like, it's a bad day, it can be perceived stress. That's the worst part of it now. It can be perceived stuff. It doesn't even have to even be real. And I'm just like, and yep, go into my office, leave me alone. And that's it. And it's not even a packing mechanism anymore. It's just a like ignoring mechanism. And it's just become more and more problematic. And I think just, you know, just in the last 2 months, I've actually started seeing a therapist, which 10 years ago, if you'd asked me, like, if I would see a therapist, I'd be, fuck no, I'm not seeing a therapist. I know what they're going to tell me. Exercise more, sleep better, drink less, and everything will be better. And I was like, I don't really want to talk about this stuff. And it's taken, you know, 10 plus years to get to the point where, like, I need to talk about this. I need to work this out. Even doing this show has kind of stirred things up in a way that I didn't expect. I think at first it was kind of
jarring.
I was
going to ask about that. Because you said you started seeing a therapist, that time period postdates the creation of this podcast.
I think I'm doing this for my kids. I want to be a better person for them. I want to be more emotionally present than my parents could be, and I want to be as mentally healthy as I can be. And particularly having what I've been through, I think it needs a little bit of work. So I'm working with a therapist that specializes in trauma, and we're doing basically some, not cognitive behavioral therapy, but DBT and EMDR, and starting into that, which is more trauma-based therapy. So, you know, we'll see how that works out.
I have to mention this because I have some friends who have worked in this space before, and I'm sure you've heard about it. Also the West Haven VA, which is the Veterans Affairs Clinic where I get my treatment, is a research leader in it. So I read quite a bit about this before I sort of heard about it / saw it. But both ketamine and psilocybin apparently have been sort of flagged as really great if used in the appropriate way in the appropriate setting, miracles when it comes to kind of like resetting the folks who are struggling with hardcore PTSD or I don't want to, the word I'm going to use to describe what you're going through is not, and what I've been through myself, beer, video games, not wanting to deal with stuff. Also just sort of like that five, like I don't get too upset about stuff, but I'm not thrilled about stuff either. Is I think the term that would walk across centuries is ennui, this French term, E-N-N-U-I, maybe. I might be leaving out an E there somewhere. There it is, yeah. And ennui is like, you know, different cultures. People have this response to different things in different cultures. Like an Occitan warlord, you know, a duke or a baron from the 12th century might ride into battle and kill a bunch of people and feel great about that. Not because they're a psychopath or a sociopath, but because it's like culturally embedded to go into battle and to feel great about that. Sometimes I feel like there's a lot of influencers today that will be like, oh, that's the mindset you've got to get. You know, the reason people feel bad about stuff today is that like, they're not killing, you know, on the battlefield, or they're not hunting or gathering. And it's like, I'm sure hunter gatherers like in their 40s or 50s got to the point where the system was working fine. It was all organized and they're there and like they got plenty of food and everything else. And they're just sort of like, I've hunted, I've gathered, like I got it. So everywhere, you know what I mean? Like everywhere at every time, there's no answer that like solves everything for everybody, I think. And I'm also, I should say, you know, I'm not all the way through it, man. I mean, like, since I got back from Ukraine this year, I went to Ukraine to train soldiers for their counteroffensive, from March to May of this year. And I got back and I have been at a solid five since getting back. And I've drunk not a ton of beer, but beer and beer adjacent stuff and played a lot of video games. And I'm just still there. I just kind of like, you know, so I don't know exactly what the answer is, but, you know, I've heard great things about ketamine and psilocybin, which I wanted to interject that.
Yeah, can I add to that? Also, there are a lot of tests with MDMA for people with PTSD, particularly from combat. There's a Michael Pollan book called How to Change Your Mind that I highly recommend. He goes into MDMA, psilocybin, and LSD, And then in his TV adaptation of it, which is much more like truncated, he goes into mescaline as well. Mescaline would be more for general, like, opening your mind, relax, learning to be at ease with the world. But the psilocybin and the MDMA, the results are like just astounding. This episode is brought to you by drugs.
So, Adrian, you bring up a good point there, and that is there is definitely some promising studies that are coming out in regards to that. That said, that field of psychiatry and psychology is still very, very much in its nascency. There is a lot of risk still involved with that, and the science has not completely proven out true with it. It's not something that we collectively recommend in medicine, and particularly in pediatrics, and it's definitely not something that I am currently seeking out in my treatment regimen. I'm going with the tried and true therapy for now. But it definitely is a conversation that bears, you know, more looking into and more talking about.
You, Eric, you mentioned that in the wake of you know, all that you've experienced, you know, that you've, I guess, I don't know if you, we would call it, I don't know if it's like irregular emotional, I don't want to say regulation or whatever. Your example of the good dinosaur.
Emotional dysregulation is the
emotional dysregulation. Well, I last week cried twice during an episode of Bluey. Does that is that anything?
No, you know what that is.
Do I need to talk to my doctor or anything?
No, you're normal, man. You're normal, man. I watch that all the time. That's just, it's that good. That show is that good.
It's just the, it that's is just that, is. That good.
It's just
okay.
That good. It's just that good.
Okay.
Something about that Australian accent makes it more, I don't know, relatable, or I don't know what it is, but it's that good. Mm-hmm. Over the years, has any of this, you know, experiences in the medical field, you think negatively affected your marriage?
Off the record. Just kidding.
No, I would say
I can cut it out if you want.
No, that's a good question. I'm willing to answer that. I would say globally, no. Becca's a very tolerant and kind person, and has been very understanding of some of my shenanigans. I would say that more of it is my internalization of realizing, like, I should be or could be a better husband. And so some of it goes back to that kind of sense of like, oh, I'm a piece of crap. And there's definitely times where I'm like, oh, I'm a shitty husband. Like, I should be doing this better. I should be more attentive to her. I should be helping more of the kids or doing something like that. But I think globally, we started dating when I was in medical school. She knew what she was getting into from the get-go. And she's seen me kind of evolve as a human being through that as well. So I think that that's given us good standing and good ground to work from. But again, a lot of the stuff that I've talked about and like I'm doing now is to be a better person. And part of that is being a better husband, which I would consider, like, when I look at my paradigm, I'd say being a good family man is number one and being a doctor is probably number two. You know, Adrian was talking about the guy that started the residency programs. Like, they looked at that as like being a doctor was like your number one. Everything else was secondary. Everything else was a far second. Whereas I don't believe that at all. To me, my family is most important, and I want to do everything I can to be there for them and be emotionally present for them and just, again, be a better person. One thing I do want to kind of like end on or fall back on and tying into something Adrian had said, I think in our first episode, where he started to kind of back away from his more stressful stuff when he realized that he couldn't be consistent about his performance. One of the hardest things in medicine, and this was particularly true and everything I experienced, whether it was ER or paramedic or even in my current day-to-day, is always being consistent with the next patient. And that has got to be one of the hardest things to do when you've just walked out of a room from telling a parent that their kid just died or seeing something horrible, taking about 10 seconds in the hall to kind of collect yourself and then go right into the next room and say, hey, I'm Dr. Shaw, what can I do for you? And doing it with a smile. That has got to be one of the hardest things that we do. And that has definitely led to some of the issues because you never really have a chance to address stuff in a timely manner. But it is part of the medical world and it's something that we all do collectively. So I think that concludes my stories. I'm still working on myself here. This is kind of a work in progress. I'm hoping that this show helps me to tie some loose ends together and makes me a better person. I hope that we can get some listeners on here to come and share their experiences and talk more about how these things have impacted them. And that they're not the only ones out there that have had similar experiences. So thank you guys for listening and taking the time to hear me out.
Yeah. Eric, can I ask you a couple questions just as a doctor?
Is this for the show?
As a pediatrician? It's for the show.
Hold on.
Oh, sorry, okay. Ryan. Did you want to play our theme song for Ask a Doctor?
No, I was. Go ahead.
One. How old is too old to see a pediatrician? When do you need to make the switch?
21. Some it's 21. 18. We'll see until 21. I'll see kids with special.
Is that a legal thing, or is that just when it gets weird?
It gets weird if you're doing too much adult shit. And just the recommendations as far as like general monitoring and health maintenance stuff changes. And we're not trained on it. We'll keep some kids longer. I shouldn't call them kids. Where it's generally more like autistic kids, complex heart defect kids, stuff where like adult doctors don't know what to do with them, or they'll have trouble navigating the adult health world, particularly like if their parents aren't as involved anymore. We'll just kind of keep them on longer.
Mm-hmm. Also, is Dimetapp as delicious as I remember it being?
Yes. Yes.
And why don't adults take Dimetapp?
Because it doesn't do anything.
Oh, it doesn't do anything? The other one was I have to do a 6-month lipid panel because of family history. Fucking aced it this time, buddy.
Nice.
COVID destroyed me.
Is that something you study for? Here's what it was.
My numbers used to always be perfect, right? Then COVID happened and back issues, and I'm staying at home. Some days I would eat like a half a gallon of ice cream, dude. It was ridiculous. I was doing all things that would make my numbers look terrible, and they didn't get really bad. The highest my total cholesterol ever was 219, I think, and that was at the end of a vacation. But I got down now to my total 172, HDL 54, LDL 101, triglycerides 76.
That's solid. That's a good number.
This is great. This is good stuff.
Back on track.
The listeners are going to be like, I stayed until the end.
We can cut that
part. No, it's going. It's going in. It's
no,
going
we
in.
Can people cut that don't, part.
We need to know your lipids. It's important. Hey, Adrian, is there anything you want to plug?
At the moment, I'm running a newsletter called Military Media, and I probably will be by the time this gets out, I expect. It's free to subscribe, and mostly it's focused on small businesses and the industries that contribute to the military, not all of which are small, many of which are big, but just trying to get my head around that because you hear things like the military-industrial complex a lot, like I did, and I didn't have a very clear picture of that. I've got a slightly clearer picture of that now, but you know, that's what I'm writing. This newsletter comes out 3 times a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. It's free to subscribe. Militarymedia.org.
Do you want to plug Wrath Baron Tree real quick?
I also co-founded a literary publication for veterans and people who have experienced trauma, which I guess some of the listeners would fall under. And publishes fiction, nonfiction, poetry, and critical essays by folks who have encountered trauma. Co-founded by myself and another combat veteran, we figured out after the first couple of years that, you know, war is just like a trauma factory. There's just a lot of trauma in war, but there's nothing special about the trauma in war. It's just trauma.
All right. Ryan, you got anything you want to plug?
Yeah, I have a new novel out called The Party. Get it on Amazon. We have three. There's the paperback, hard copy, and ebook. It's a sort of political satire, dystopian fiction, and it's funny. It's been described to me as Orwell meets The Naked Gun. So it's silly and serious.
I think that's going to do it for this episode. So thanks for listening. See you next time.
Thanks for listening. Please take a moment and leave a review for the podcast. We would really appreciate it. Only a good review. If you have something negative to say, just tell your friend or you know, whoever's sitting near you, whether you know them or not. Don't put that on the internet. We don't need that. Also, please subscribe. It helps us, and you know, it'll help you get the podcast right when it comes out. Also, please visit our podcast at thebaggagepodcast.com. I do not know what is on the website. I have never been, but I'm sure it's great. Probably basketball scores and stuff like that. Also, if you have a story or a question that you would like to share with us, please email us at thebaggagepodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much, and we will, I was going to say see you soon, but that would be a lie. We will talk at you soon. Bye.